From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jane Clayson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The chief of the Washington Metropolitan Police told a Senate committee today that he was stunned by the reluctance of officials to immediately deploy the National Guard to the U.S. Capitol building as it was being overrun by a mob on January 6th. Today is the first of several public hearings this week to investigate the security failures that day. Former Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sun testified that it was the worst attack he's ever seen on law enforcement, with police officers outmatched by members of right-wing extremist groups who came prepared for war.
Based on the intelligence that we received, we planned for an increased level of violence at the Capitol and that some participants may be armed. But none of the intelligence we received predicted what actually occurred.
Joining us now is Malcolm Nance. He's a former Navy intelligence officer who specializes in counterinsurgency. Malcolm, welcome back. Good to speak with you.
Good to be here.
And we just heard today in that clip that there was intelligence that a mob was coming to the Capitol, but no one predicted a military-style assault. How could that be?
Well, I'm not sure whether he is being quite accurate in his words. Maybe Chief Sund himself wasn't aware of that, but there was certainly a lot of intelligence out there. You know, my group, we monitor right-wing extremist chat and, you know, on Facebook, Telegram, Instagram, all of these places. And all throughout December, starting around the 14th, 15th of December, the mobilization for a rally on January 6th called Stop the Steal, it was also known as Fight for Trump, was heavily coordinated. And in some of the more extremist chats on Parler and places like the Donald.win, it was very clear that they were there to stop the actual certification of the electoral process. And they were advertising that they were going to storm the Capitol. In fact, you could order T-shirts from Etsy with the term storm the Capitol on it. Law enforcement intelligence seemed to know. Capitol Hill Police Own Intelligence Division put a warning that this could take place. But for them to say that they had no idea that it would happen at that scale, that's just a gross failure on their part.
Well, and Malcolm, I'll point out that the day after the Capitol insurrection, you and I spoke, you said the same thing. That was one day afterwards. So clearly there was some information out there. Now, there are questions today about why the National Guard wasn't called in sooner than it was. Former House Sergeant-at-Arms Paul Irving said his concern about the bad optics of sending troops to the Capitol was mischaracterized. Are you hearing any explanation today that makes sense to you?
No, I'm not. And by, you know, the terms that were used, according to reporting from the New York Times, is that, you know, he didn't want to see lines of soldiers with the Capitol behind them. Well, we saw that. We saw that last June and July during the Black Lives Matter protest at, you know, around the Capitol when they did their march. But it's pretty standard if you think that you're going to have a very, very large crowd to bring out the D.C. National Guard. And one of the things that I'm almost convinced of, and I'm saying this as a counterterrorism professional, is that the national security infrastructure of the Trump administration and his supporters in the Defense Department on Capitol Hill was that this crowd of 40,000 Trump supporters, who was overwhelmingly white, were not considered a threat because they were armored in the privilege of their skin color and their voting record. They were not what Black Lives Matter. They were not any other group. But back to what law enforcement should have known. We knew after indictments were put out in Michigan in last October, November, that the Michigan militia plotted to do the exact same thing as a plan B to their operation to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer and try her and execute her. If they couldn't do that, they had planned to take 200 armed men, seize the Capitol building in Michigan, and then create a hostage barricade and start executing politicians. So in my world, which is, you know, terrorism intelligence, that would have been the minimum standard that should have been prepared for at any time on Capitol Hill.
I do want to take a step back because there's other related news this week on Capitol Hill. In his confirmation hearing yesterday, Attorney General nominee Merrick Garland testified about the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing, which of course he investigated and prosecuted for the Justice Department. Let's listen.
We are facing a more dangerous period than we faced in Oklahoma City at that time. I don't yet know what additional resources would be required by the department. I can assure you that this will be my first priority and my first briefing.
Malcolm, we have 45 seconds, but what should Garland's focus be on day one if he's confirmed?
Day one should be that the United States will find and prosecute the people that carried out this insurrection. This is a dangerous event. There are many more potential Timothy McVeighs today than there were back in the mid-1990s. And the FBI does not have the resources for what potentially is to come.
All right. Well, the Senate hearings will continue this week. We'll continue to follow them. Malcolm Nance, National Security Analyst, thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure.
A heartbreaking milestone. That's how President Joe Biden described the more than 500,000 Americans who have now died from COVID-19. President Biden and Vice President Harris held a solemn ceremony last night, surrounded by candles, lining the White House steps to the balcony.
We have to resist becoming numb to the sorrow. We have to resist viewing each life as a statistic or a blur or on the news. We must do so to honor the dead, but equally important, care for the living, those left behind.
President Biden is now focused on ramping up vaccinations across the country. So far, more than 64 million doses have been administered in the United States. But still, many Americans are hesitant to get vaccinated, even when scientists say the vaccine offers a clear path out of the pandemic. So how do we talk to each other about all this? Georgia Public Broadcasting's Grant Blankenship reports.
When I met David Lee on his way out of a drive-through COVID test in Macon, Georgia not long ago, he told me he'd already been through a pretty tough bout with the virus.
I hadn't really regained my smell at all, but I've noticed my taste has gotten worse, and I'm having a lot of the same symptoms.
As bad as he had it, Lee said it was his parents, both 68, he was worried about.
My father almost died in July, so I'm hoping that they can get to the front of the line the quickest.
That's the vaccine line where he wants his parents. Turns out his wife and kids, they'd had COVID-19 too. And so I thought David Lee would be more than ready to get his coronavirus vaccine. I was wrong.
Well, as somebody that has a wife that's in the healthcare field, there's some concern that this may have not been fully vetted as much as it should have been.
David Lee is not alone. Just over 30% of the people polled recently by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution said they weren't interested in the vaccine, even if scientists guaranteed it was safe. The CDC found that the majority of workers in long-term care homes weren't on board either.
I'd like to wait a couple more months until, you know, let it play out and let the majority of healthcare workers get exposed again and see how they do.
So, odds are you may know someone like David Lee, and maybe you think you can talk them into the vaccine. So where do you start? Amber Schmidtke says, first, remember, it's not about you proving someone wrong. You're talking to another human being with human fears and human concerns.
And those fears and concerns are valid.
Schmidtke is the public health microbiologist and science communicator whose Georgia coronavirus newsletter has kept many people in the know during the pandemic. She says the vaccine conversation is really about letting the hesitant person take the wheel.
I ask more questions than I provide answers. You know, I'm just trying to understand better so that, you know, if I happen to have a solution for you, then I'll offer it.
So, for instance, she says don't start justifying why vaccine trials were conducted so quickly unless someone has told you that's where their fear lies and they ask you what you think. You have to listen first. Otherwise, it's likely to be a short conversation and it might not end in a vaccination.
I'm not here to browbeat somebody into getting it done.
Shanti Akers takes the same tack, even if it means really forcing herself to sit on her hands.
The day they told me we had the vaccine here and I could get it, I mean, I was almost vibrating.
A pulmonary intensivist at Phoebe Putney Memorial Hospital in Albany, Georgia, Acres saw the worst of the pandemic last spring when Albany was a global hotspot. And yet,
we've had several staff members that have refused the vaccine.
But Acres says she doesn't push. She waits. And she listens to her coworkers.
It's been in that personal interaction with me, being on the unit, hearing one of them say, Dr. Acres, you're getting the vaccine? And I've said, yeah, of course I'm getting the vaccine.
Acres says she treats questions like that as an invitation to keep things down to earth. If a coworker asks her why she got the vaccine, she tells them, because I don't want to take this home to my husband or our kids.
I want nothing more for you than what's good enough for my own family.
And she says that approach has changed minds.
I've had people get vaccinated because they said, well, Dr. Acres, you convinced me. Or, you know, we had the conversation, but it required a conversation.
And finally, Acres says give advice from a place of hope. For Here and Now, I'm Grant Blankenship in Macon, Georgia.
Out today, a hauntingly beautiful memoir about family and identity. Elizabeth Miki Brina is the child of a white Vietnam War veteran and the nightclub hostess he met in Okinawa, Japan. The two married and moved to the United States. Elizabeth, their only child, grew up in a New York suburb, feeling unconnected both to her Okinawan mother and her mostly white peers. It was only as an adult that Elizabeth realized how her family history had shaped her life and her relationship with her parents. She writes about it in the book Speak Okinawa. And Elizabeth Miki Brina joins me now. Welcome. So nice to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
You write early on about your childhood, and it sounds as though your mother was someone you hardly thought about because she was cleaning rooms and doing laundry and going off to work in restaurants. It was your father who was really the guiding force in your life early on. Is that true?
It's very true, unfortunately. I grew up in a predominantly white suburb, so I had always felt very outcasted. And I blamed my mother for it. Like, I think intuitively as a child, I knew that my mother was the reason why I didn't fit in and I didn't belong because she is so different from everybody else. So I rejected her from a very young age, rejected her and ignored her. Along with that, too, my father, has such a strong personality, right? Very dominant personality. So he was always stepping in and overcompensating, right? Like, I think that that's how he felt like he could fix it. It's just like, okay, well, I'll be everything. A big part of it as well was the language barrier. And this is something I didn't realize for a long time growing up, is how huge that was in my family, that my mother didn't speak English as her native language. Like, she couldn't communicate in a way that felt like the most comfortable for her.
That's interesting. Yes, you write about being ashamed that your mother didn't speak English as well as,
right,
as you did. But your mother seemed mm-hmm. ashamed, too, of her Japanese. She spoke with a dialect yeah. particular to Okinawa, and she was somehow ashamed of that.
Yeah, she grew up speaking a dialect of Japanese that was very shamed and belittled within the history of Okinawa. So there's that shame of just my Japanese isn't good enough to people from the mainland. And then, yes, and then to come to America and have that other shame of just like, I don't speak English well enough.
I don't speak English well enough, which mm-hmm. led, it seems to me, you know, my English isn't good enough. I'm not good enough. And mm-hmm. you write a lot yeah. About that. And you also write a lot about the guilt of your teenage years, how mm-hmm. you dyed your hair blonde, you listened to punk music, you hung out with friends who stole from your mom. You write that you didn't yeah. care because you'd already learned that, quote, my mother wasn't important. What did you mean by mm-hmm. that in the context of your identity and hers?
Well, I just grew up feeling so inferior. I always felt different. I always felt removed and disconnected. And so I internalized that inferiority. I was so desperate to fit in too. Like, I just let my friends do anything. And yeah. And the fact that, right, they stole from my mother, you know, they never stole from my dad, right? Like, I think that that was part of it, too. I think ingrained in them, they knew that this is something we can get away with.
So the book isn't only a story about your family. You also explore Okinawa itself. Okinawa, of course, an island off the mainland of Japan. It's also treated as having a lower status. Is it not within the country?
Yeah. So Okinawa, for a very long time, was a colony of China. And then it was a colony of Japan. And so being considered not really a part of the country for so long, but just subjugated, right? And it was used as a pawn during World War II, during the Battle of Okinawa. It was pretty much just discarded as, like, this is the last line of defense. We're just going to let the Americans destroy this island so that we can prove to them, like, what they're up against if they come to mainland Japan. So there's always this, we're forsaken, right? We're lesser. And even now, to the present day, with the military bases, 75% of all military bases in Japan are actually located on Okinawa. And the Okinawans, they don't have much of a say about what these bases do on their island.
Right. It's a difficult relationship that Okinawa has with the United States, which, as you say, has had a continual military presence there for generations. And as you learned more about it, that really shaped your feelings about yourself as an American with Okinawan heritage, did it not?
Yeah, I mean, I had no idea, right? When I learned this history, it was really like just discovering myself, right? When I learned like what had happened to Okinawa, and my mother was born 3 years after the Battle of Okinawa, and so she grew up and it was a completely like devastated island, you know, just grief and poverty and trauma. So she absorbed all that. And then also she witnessed the militarization and all the horrendous crimes that people from the U.S. military were committing on to Okinawans. So she absorbed that sadness. And then when she raised me, I absorbed her sadness too. So it's like this perpetuating of history. And when I learned about this, it was quite a revelation because it just helped me understand what was happening to her and what was happening to me.
And so what did you want readers to understand about your Japanese heritage, your American heritage, your identity in the context of that?
I want people to understand the repercussions of colonialism, imperialism, that it doesn't just stop when the actual direct acts stop, right? They keep going. We internalize these traumas, we inherit these traumas, and then it sets us up for how we navigate the world. And it affects families and individuals like long after the events occur.
Has writing this book helped you to forgive yourself for the way you behaved toward your mother growing up? Because the way you described the process of forgiveness, I think, was so beautiful and so raw and so relatable.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, forgiving myself, that's a hard one, right? It's definitely helped me make peace with it because it has helped me repair my relationship with my mother. You know, through writing this book, I learned her heritage, but also her personal history, her life history. I got to ask her all these questions. We found a way to just talk to each other. I feel like our relationship is healed now, and that's definitely helped me to forgive myself.
Elizabeth Miki Brina, memoir is Speak Okinawa. Elizabeth, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you for this.
Well, more than 500,000 people have died in the U.S. from COVID-19 since the pandemic began just about a year ago. NPR is remembering some of those lost by listening to the music they loved and hearing their stories. We're calling our tribute Songs of Remembrance. Today, Margaret Garza of Houston, Texas, tells us about her big sister, Leticia Gloria, also known as Nina, who passed away at the age of 69.
My sister Nina, her name was actually Leticia Gloria, but we always called her Nina growing up. She was born in 1952. And the best description I've heard of her is a kind soul with a very, very soft-spoken voice. She was very soft-spoken, very kind, very generous. She came from a huge family. There were seven of us, six girls. When we were growing up in the 60s, I was very, very young, and Nina was a teenager. I was, five, and she was 15. Music was such a big part of our lives because there were so many of us, and we were very poor. We grew up so poor, but having Nina shepherd me around the house, having Nina there with me, made life normal. And I always felt like I had a really good childhood, that radio was always on and we would sing. For some reason, when she died, that song, 96 Tears, just kept coming to me. And it's by Question Mark and the Mysterians. And when I was a child, I always thought it was Question Mark and the Mysterious. And it was one that my sister played a lot, and it was one that they would dance to. And something about that song just to this day reminds me of her. And after all these years, I had not heard that song in many, many years. And when I replayed it recently and listened to the words, it took on a totally different meaning. Too many teardrops for one heart to be crying. Too many teardrops for one heart to carry on. For the tears that we've all been shedding, it's been a lot more than 96 tears, but it's kind of fitting, I think. To carry
on. You can visit our tribute, NPR's Songs of Remembrance, at npr.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at zooty.com.
One of the premier science fiction writers of the 20th century, Octavia Butler imagined worlds that were radically different and strikingly similar to the one we live in today.
For our Black History Month special series, The Cautionary Tales and the Reasons for Hope that Octavia Butler left us.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
Staff members for state lawmakers in Oregon want to form a union. That might seem like an easy task in a labor-friendly state, but as Oregon Public Broadcasting's Dirk Vanderhart reports, it's complicated.
Labor unions have done as much as anyone to shape Oregon's current political trajectory. With the help of their funding and armies of volunteers, Democrats have run the table here. The party holds every statewide office and controls both chambers of the legislature. That's a long way of saying that when staffers at the state capitol began an organizing attempt in December, there were plenty of reasons to think they'd succeed.
The motivators for folks are similar to what you would see in any workplace. There's a desire for a voice at the table, an ability to have meaningful input in decisions that legislative administration is making that impact our workplace.
That's Logan Gillis. He's a longtime staffer for a longtime state senator. Last year, after some high-profile changes to rules governing workplace harassment and pay policies in the Capitol, Gillis and other legislative aides got to talking.
How do we as legislative aides make sure that we're being considered, that we're being consulted, and really that we can help inform those decisions? Because we are a unique set of workers that generally acts as the interface between the general public and their government.
The answer, they decided, was to file to form a union. If successful, they would become the first partisan statehouse staff in the country to unionize. That's if they can get past their bosses, or at any rate, the attorneys who represent their bosses. The state's Department of Justice has responded to the union push with a laundry list of objections. The department declined to be interviewed for this story, but has at various times claimed a legislative union might be unconstitutional and that aides don't have a statutory right to organize like virtually all other state employees. Tony Ruiz is an organizer with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, which is seeking to represent Capitol staff.
You know, we had hoped it wouldn't go this path, obviously, but we did prepare the bargain unit for there being potential challenges.
The union had reason to expect opposition. In early 2020, staffers in the Delaware legislature tried to unionize. Just like in Oregon, Delaware is controlled by labor-friendly Democrats. But the union drive quickly stalled when legislative leaders argued it would be unconstitutional. Kat Caudill was an organizer with that effort.
It's no different than, you know, Amazon workers in Alabama trying to organize and their bosses saying, well, no, you can't do this, right? Like, they just became bosses is what it essentially came down to.
Caudill says labor groups in Delaware and elsewhere are now eagerly waiting to see how the Oregon battle will play out. It's not clear all lawmakers in Oregon are necessarily comfortable with the arguments against a staff union. A coalition of Democrats are pushing a bill that could clarify that their aides have the right to unionize. And the state's House Speaker, Tina Kotek, has tried to downplay the objections raised by attorneys.
They are defined as objections, and that is because that's what they're called. I like to think of them more as clarifying questions.
Clarifying or not, the questions will help decide whether Oregon aides are granted the chance to unionize or become another cautionary tale. An administrative hearing on the matter is set to begin Thursday. For Here and Now, I'm Dirk Vanderhart in Portland, Oregon.
South Korean intelligence officials say North Korea tried to steal COVID-19 vaccine information from the drug maker Pfizer, which is worth noting because North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un has said his country is coronavirus-free. It is difficult to know what's going on inside the isolated country, but we do know that Kim closed the border with China in response to the pandemic, and he even admitted last month that his economic policies have failed. Let's get some insight from Victor Cha. He's Senior Vice President and Korea Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's on a Skype line. Victor, welcome.
Thanks, Peter.
And what do you make of this story? South Korea claiming that North Korea tried to steal vaccine technology from Pfizer.
Well, I think it just shows how concerned North Korea is about the pandemic seeping into their country. They don't have a public health infrastructure system to speak of. And they have reacted in a similar fashion with regard to previous pandemics, whether it's been the Ebola virus in West Africa or the Middle East respiratory syndrome that hit South Korea a few years ago. So they're quite paranoid on a good day, but in this case, they're extremely worried about COVID getting into the country.
Should we believe Kim Jong-un that North Korea is free of COVID-19?
Well, as you said in the lead, it's hard to know what's going on inside the country. Most of the NGO groups have all been kicked out. Most of the diplomatic personnel has left. So there's very little ground intelligence about what's going on there. It's certainly plausible that they have no cases in their country because they have sealed the border now for over a year. But at the same time, even if they have no cases, they're arguably the country most affected by COVID because of the way they have sealed off the country and allowed the economy to go into free fall. Again, over a year without any interaction with the outside world.
And so, well, that's a very interesting point. If that's true, that it is the country that's most affected by COVID in one way or another, how much devastation could it bring or is it bringing to the country, do you think?
Well, we do know that after 1 year of being closed, sealing the border off with China, their economy contracted by somewhere between 8% and 10%, which would be higher than the contractions in the economy in the mid-90s when they suffered a famine that killed 10% of the population. And then that also means when they close the border, the one country they trade with, China, is also not being able to either send supplies, send vaccines, or send commerce across the border. In addition to that, in the summer, this past summer, they had the worst flooding they've ever had in decades, which has really affected the food supply in the country, the fall harvest. So in many ways, it's kind of a triple whammy. The floods in August and then COVID and then the shutdown of the border has really put the economy in a difficult position.
Go back to that famine in the 1990s that you mentioned. Of course, it was just absolutely devastating. Were there any parallels to what happened there with what might be unfolding now during a new health crisis?
The famine in the 1990s was largely brought about by the end of Soviet patron assistance. At that time, Soviet patron assistance to North Korea in the form of heavily subsidized energy imports. This then created an energy crisis in the country. They deforested the country because they had no fuel. And then when they had the annual rains, that led to a lot of flooding, which then, you know, cascaded into a famine. I think in the current situation, you know, we just don't know how much of a cushion the economy has that they can weather something like this. We also have to think that they've stayed shut down for a year, and the rest of the world, we're looking at being not returning to normal, possibly, you know, till the end of this coming year, as the President Biden said the other day, at least for the United States, which means North Korea is going to stay shut down even longer. And whether they can weather 2 years or longer of being shut down, it's very difficult to say.
What does that mean for Kim Jong-un? Is his leadership in danger?
I think one of the biggest concerns that I have is that they seem to be saying in some of their statements, public statements to their own people, that the government is going to take control of the markets to try to take hard currency out of the markets for the government's use. That sort of anti-market activity really upsets the North Korean people. Again, this is largely a centrally planned public distribution system, but there are markets in the country. And whenever the government does things like this, they try to undertake anti-market activity and squelch the savings and the disposable income of the public. The public gets really angry at that. So that could create some internal turmoil.
So in other words, on a very small scale, individuals are able to make some money here and there by selling goods at a market or something to that effect. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're a farmer, there's an allotment you have to produce for the state, but then anything you produce above that is your own and you can sell it in the markets. And so, you know, if you give North Koreans just a sliver of daylight, they will take that opportunity and try to do better for themselves.
Yeah. Well, as we have reported on for the last 4 years, President Trump made a very big deal of his relationship with Kim. They met three different times. They exchanged, as Trump said, beautiful letters with each other. But of course, it didn't really result in anything. There was no movement on the geopolitical scale, really, nothing on denuclearization. How would you advise the Biden administration now to approach North Korea, considering what we've just been talking about?
Well, you know, it's a good question, and there's no easy answers when it comes to North Korea and denuclearization. I agree with you that Trump did not really accomplish anything aside from giving the North Korean leader a great deal of legitimacy. Meanwhile, the weapons programs have just grown. Denuclearization, of course, is the objective, but you have to stop the unimpeded growth of the programs, whether that's through a testing freeze or through a fissile material production ban, nuclear reactor operations freeze. We have to undertake those steps first to try to build a platform for having an expert working level negotiation, not the sort of made-for-TV summits that really had no substance behind it that led to agreements on paper that the North Koreans just use as window dressing as they continue to improve their capabilities.
Victor Cha, Senior Vice President and Korea Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and a professor at Georgetown University. Thanks for your insights.
Thanks, Peter.
Two contentious and groundbreaking nominations for President Biden's cabinet are being considered on Capitol Hill today. Congresswoman Deb Haaland is facing the Senate Energy Committee in her hearing to become Interior Secretary. And Javier Becerra is in front of the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. Biden nominated him to be Health and Human Services Secretary. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson joins us now. Hi, Mara.
Hi there.
Let's start with Congresswoman Haaland, the first Native American nominated for a cabinet position. Tell us more about her and what questions she's facing today.
Yes, Deb Haaland is a congresswoman. She's the first, as you said, Native American nominated for a cabinet position. She has been very out front on environmental issues, which of course affect Native Americans a lot. She has been on record against fracking. She has been a sharp critic of fossil fuel development. So, not surprisingly, she's getting a lot of pushback from Republicans who, even as the party has lost support with various industry groups, big corporations, finance, high tech, fossil fuels are part of their constituents, mm-hmm. fossil fuel companies. So she's getting a lot of pushback. What they say are her extreme views on fossil fuels on federal lands.
What about Javier Becerra? It would be the first Latino HHS secretary, if confirmed. Tell us more about him and what he's been talking about today.
Yes, this is another, there's a theme here. These nominees are all people of color, and they're all getting a lot of pushback. But Javier Becerra has been, who was a congressman, has been deeply involved with health issues for a long time. He at one point was for Medicare for All. That's something that Joe Biden isn't for. So just like Deb Haaland, who is for, but Joe Biden does not, he now works for Joe Biden. So he will be tasked with carrying out vaccines, pandemic relief, and also improving Obamacare, but not instituting Medicare for All, because that's something that Biden doesn't agree with. He's gotten some tough questions today. One congressman, Richard Burr from North Carolina, said he doesn't think he has the necessary experience or skills to do this job. And it's unclear yet how whether the Republican moderates, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Mitt Romney, how they will vote on Becerra.
Okay. And what about Neera Tanden, Biden's budget nomination? Of all the cabinet positions, she's really getting the most pushback. Tell us about that. Is the nomination going to survive? We have about 20 seconds.
Yep. Neera Tanden, another woman of color. She's South Asian American. She has been getting the most pushback. Many, many Democrats think she won't survive because Joe Manchin isn't going to vote for her, Democrat. And so far, no Republican has stepped up to replace his vote. So it looks like her nomination is in the most trouble.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. As always, Mara, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
If you're a Facebook user in Australia, you can once again find and share news on your timeline. Facebook is restoring news pages in Australia following a week-long standoff over proposed legislation that would force social media companies to pay news organizations to host their content. Sarah Morrison, who covers personal data and privacy for Recode, has been following the story, and she joins us now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Jane. How you doing?
Well, I'm good. Tell us about what happened on February 17th. Facebook started blocking Australian users from sharing or viewing news content, which was in retaliation for some proposed changes to the country's media laws. Help us understand what the Australian government was trying to do.
So this law is sort of one of the results of the country trying to look into antitrust and like competitive practices and market power of Google and Facebook. They recommended a law that would require those two companies to have to pay news organizations if they had links to their contents, like Google search and Facebook shares. The two companies responded to that law, which hasn't passed yet, but it's pretty close to it. Google ended up making a bunch of deals with several media companies. Facebook responded last week, as we saw, by just cutting it all off entirely. So it wouldn't have to worry about the law because it didn't have any links to share in the first place.
Right. So tell me more about that. Facebook announced today that it would reverse this ban after reaching agreements with the Australian government to amend this proposed legislation. Talk about that. Talk about that decision.
Yeah. So the thing is, when Facebook did that ban, it was pretty clumsy and so suddenly that it also caught a lot of news pages and links up that weren't news. Facebook's a company that isn't like looked upon too kindly by most people anyway, and it kind of really looked like bullies here, even though a lot of experts thought that the law itself was problematic. So Facebook, I guess, talked to the Australian government. The Australian government talked to Facebook. They've now decided that there's a few amendments that have been added to the law that Facebook thinks that it can live with. So it's at this point it says restoring the links, and it's actually already started making deals with some media companies. So it looks like basically those deals with the amendments, I guess, say that it won't have to deal with, you know, the law won't apply to it because it will have made these deals outside of it anyway. Mm. So which Google has also already done.
I see. So last year, Facebook spent more on lobbying than any other big tech company. I think it was like $19 million. How does this illustrate this situation, Facebook's influence and power over governments around the world?
I mean, it's tricky because I think Facebook obviously has had a lot of that, and it's been able to, as it shows with Australia, it doesn't like being regulated, doesn't like being forced to do anything, and it does a lot and spends a lot to avoid that, and it's mostly gotten away with it up until this point. It sort of tried to bully an entire country and all the people in it.
Yeah.
I think that might have, it says it got what it wanted, but I think that largely backfired. And I think we're also seeing, you know, other countries considering similar laws. And the American government obviously is looking into various things about Facebook and big tech in general and their power and ways of checking them. So it's spent a lot of money. It's tried to prevent this. I think we've increasingly seen the repercussions of letting these companies do a lot of this stuff unchecked, and we're starting to check them.
Well, speak more about that, because Canada and the United Kingdom are also considering similar legislation to regulate the influence of social media companies. So what are these other companies learning from the Australia experience?
Well, I think Google's probably pretty pleased that it avoided a lot of this by just sort of making the deals before it had to, and not getting that kind of backlash. I'm not exactly sure how this all plays out, but it looks like, you know, they're seeing that they can't do the things they did before. They can't bully countries. They can't bully governments, even when that's quote unquote as small as Australia has fought back. So and largely stood their ground. So they're going to have to make a lot of decisions, especially when it comes to, you know, the United Kingdom, European Union, and America, if this is the policy they want to continue to take based on the results that they've so far gotten.
And specifically in the United States, the response there?
I think a lot of people don't look that kindly upon Facebook, especially lately. So I think people just felt like Facebook was being mean, and just trying to bully an entire country and show off how much power they had. You could say that Facebook did that in order to show how much power they had. And either that shows you that you need to let it keep doing what it's doing, or that you need to stop it. And that's sort of a bet Facebook made. And I don't know if that'll pay off for them or not yet.
Well, that's Sarah Morrison with Recode explaining this very interesting situation in Australia with Facebook and Google. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jane Clayson in Boston.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now.